negotiations to continue in Saudi Arabia.
The aim, according to an official statement, is to, quote, advance President Donald Trump's goal to end the Russia-Ukraine war.
Hundreds killed in Syria.
Syria's interim president Ahmed Shara scrambled to contain the violence on Sunday as he called for peace outside a mosque in Damascus. He urged Syrians not to let sectarian tensions further destabilize the country, which has seen relative calm after Assad was toppled in December.
And AI for everyone in one Eastern European country.
But essentially it just comes down to that, you know, the kids coming out of the school, going to the unis, going to the labor market, would really know how to, like, literally make the most of these things available, things like ChatGPT.
Today is Monday, March 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. It's been a wild week for those following the negotiations around ending Russia's war in Ukraine. But even as U.S.-led peace negotiations have recently faced setbacks, talks between Washington and Kyiv are set to take place this week in Saudi Arabia. VOA's Veronica Baldaris Iglesias has the details.
To promote peace around
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio traveled Sunday to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to hold talks with a Ukrainian delegation. The aim, according to an official statement, is to, quote, advance President Donald Trump's goal to end the Russia-Ukraine war. The visit comes days after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky sent President Trump a conciliatory letter in the aftermath of a contentious meeting the leaders had at the White House on February 28. Trump commented Friday on the status of the peace negotiations.
I think we're doing very well with Russia. But right now they're bombing the hell out of Ukraine. And Ukraine, I'm finding it more difficult, frankly, to deal with Ukraine. And they don't have the cards.
As a form of pressure to get the parties to the negotiating table, Trump has paused military aid to Ukraine and intelligence sharing with Kyiv, while threatening to impose sanctions and tariffs on Russia. Securing a deal is important for Trump politically, analysts note. William Pomerantz is a senior scholar at the Cannon Institute. He was interviewed via Zoom.
He has bet, essentially, his presidency that some sort of deal will be obtained. And I don't know, there's so many moving players during these negotiations, whether it's Russia, Ukraine, the EU.
In the lead-up to the U.S.-Ukrainian talks in Jeddah, which are expected to last until March 12, supporters of Ukraine rallied Saturday in Washington, while Ukrainian officials denounced a series of Russian attacks over the weekend against Ukrainian targets in Donetsk, among other regions. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
We heard about the march in support of Ukraine in Washington in Veronica's story. Several hundred pro-Ukrainian protesters also gathered at Berlin's Brandenburg Gate on Sunday to express their concerns about the recent souring of U.S.-Ukraine relations.
Das ist eine große Verrat und Enttäuschung in ukrainischer
Gesellschaft. Irina Sholokhina is a protest organizer. She says that Ukrainians are feeling disappointment and betrayal that one of their biggest partners would concede to the aggressor. She says that Ukrainians are angry and they hope that Europe will get stronger. Elsewhere on Sunday, Russia's defense ministry released videos of what it said to be suicide drone strikes on a Ukrainian military column in Russia's Kursk region. Ukrainian troops seized about 1,300 square kilometers of the region in August of last year in what Kyiv said was an attempt to gain a bargaining chip in future negotiations and to force Russia to shift forces from eastern Ukraine. Open-source maps on Friday showed Kyiv's contingent in Kursk nearly surrounded after rapid Russian advances. Now to the Middle East. A Trump administration hostage negotiator has called his recent meetings with representatives of the U.S.-designated terror group Hamas helpful. This as Israel says it plans to deploy a delegation this week to discuss ceasefire talks. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has that story.
Thousands of protesters in Israel gathered outside the defense ministry in Tel Aviv this weekend. They demanded the Israeli government broker a hostage release deal with Hamas In Washington last week, U.S. President Donald Trump confirmed his administration had, for the first time, held direct talks with Hamas, a departure from the longstanding U.S. policy not to negotiate with terrorists.
We are having discussions with Hamas. We are helping Israel in those discussions because we're talking about Israeli hostages. And we're not doing anything in terms of Hamas. We're not giving cash. And in fact, I got 59 hostages out and we gave nothing. In 59, we gave nothing.
Sunday morning, supporters and relatives of hostages awoke in tents outside the Israel Defense Ministry. Their message was clear. No new conflicts with Hamas, just secure a hostage release deal.
There are dozens of people that came with us to say the government don't get inside Gaza again. Stop this war and bring all the hostages back home.
In recent days, a Trump administration negotiator met with Hamas to discuss a hostage release deal, calling the meeting very helpful.
I think something could come together within weeks. I will say that I believe there is enough there to make a deal between what Hamas wants and what they've accepted, and what Israel wants and it's accepted. And I think I think there is a deal where they can get all of the prisoners out, not just the Americans.
In the meantime, for Palestinians in Gaza's Khan Yunis, shortages of basic needs continue. Israel imposed a total blockade on all goods entering the enclave, including food, fuel, and medicine, until Hamas frees the remaining 59 hostages still held in Gaza. People here say they wait for hours to get bread as there's no longer electricity or firewood for cooking. Israel says it plans to send a delegation to Qatar on Monday to advance negotiations with Egyptian and Qatari mediators. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The death toll from 4 days of clashes between Syrian security forces and loyalists of ousted President Bashar al-Assad and revenge killings that have followed have risen to more than 1,000, making it some of the deadliest violence since Syria's conflict began 14 years ago. Diane To of Reuters has our story.
Crowds of Syrians protested in the capital Damascus on Sunday, demanding an end to an outbreak of deadly violence that has killed many civilians. It came as clashes continued for a fourth day in the coastal heartland of deposed President Bashar al-Assad between Assad loyalists and forces backing the country's new leaders. Syria's interim president Ahmed Shara scrambled to contain the violence on Sunday as he called for peace outside a mosque in Damascus. He urged Syrians not to let sectarian tensions further destabilize the country, which has seen relative calm after Assad was toppled in December. Meanwhile, people were mourning on Sunday at a funeral for a student who was killed in the coastal Latakia province, one of the main areas of fighting. War Monitor Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said more than 1,000 people, mostly civilians, have been killed. It said women and children of Assad's Alawite religious minority were among the dead, and that the death toll was one of the highest since a chemical weapons attack on a Damascus suburb by Assad's forces in 2013. Authorities said the violence began after Assad loyalists launched deadly and well-planned attacks on their forces on Thursday. It sent security forces to crack down on the growing insurgency. Thousands of armed supporters of the new leaders showed up from across the country to back the Syrian troops before the battles spiraled into revenge killings. Syrian authorities have blamed unruly militias for summary executions and deadly raids in Alawite villages and towns. In graphic footage obtained from social media over the past days, bodies were seen strewn on the ground in Latakia. Reuters was able to verify the locations of the videos, but not the date or the identity of the dead. Shara on Friday told Syria that Assad loyalists and those who had committed crimes would be pursued and brought to trial, adding that those who harm unarmed civilians would be held severely accountable. On Sunday, Shara's office said it was forming an independent committee to investigate the clashes and killings by both sides.
That's Diane To of Reuters reporting for us. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Mark Carney, the former governor of both the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England, has won the Liberal Party race to become the next Canadian Prime Minister, succeeding Justin Trudeau. Carney is expected to be sworn in and take office in the coming days. The U.S. State Department on Sunday ordered non-emergency government personnel to leave South Sudan's capital as tensions escalate because of fighting in the north. An armed group clashed with the country's army Tuesday, leading to the arrests of two government ministers and a deputy army chief allied to the former rebel-turned-vice president, Riek Machar. Machar's home was surrounded by the army as his supporters said that the arrests were threatening the country's peace agreement. The 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday was commemorated Sunday in Selma, Alabama. Bloody Sunday was the name given to one of the most pivotal moments of the civil rights movement in the American South. On March 7, 1965, protesters were marching from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, protesting the refusal to allow black Americans to register to vote. They were met with crushing violence from police after crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge. News coverage of the event showed the rest of the U.S. and the world the vicious lengths white authorities in the South would go to preserve segregation and white supremacy. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. A look at an award-winning documentary about making art in wartime, coming up shortly. Now, though, for U.S. news and politics, this week has been a roller coaster regarding U.S. tariffs with its biggest trading partners and closest neighbors. At midnight Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump imposed 25% tariffs on Canadian and Mexican imports, sparking fears of a trade war. A day later, the U.S. announced temporary exemptions and delays, leaving Mexico dealing with uncertainty. Veronica Villafañe has our story.
Mexico is the United States' top trading partner. In 2024, it exported almost $506 billion in goods, with the top three sectors being automotive, electronics and machinery, and agriculture.
Tariffs, 25%. On Canada and 25% on Mexico. And
that on Tuesday, hours after the tariffs were imposed, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said she would defend her country's interests.
We have decided to respond with tariff and non-tariff measures, which I will announce in a public square next Sunday.
El próximo domingo.
A 25% tariff could result in export losses for Mexico of $26 billion to $42 billion, according to nonpartisan think tank Wilson Center.
La economía mexicana
quebraría, the Mexican economy would collapse. It would be devastating, and not only for the economy in the abstract, but for the economy of Mexican families.
On Wednesday, the White House announced it would exempt cars from the tariffs. On Thursday, following a phone call with Sheinbaum, Trump paused tariffs on other goods that comply with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, negotiated during his first term. While Trump shared his decision on social media, Sheinbaum described her conversation with Trump as respectful about shared interests.
Why? Now that you impose the tariffs, how are we going to continue cooperating, collaborating with something that harms the people of Mexico?
And we reached this agreement that really benefits both nations.
Despite the temporary reprieve, Mexican business leaders remain concerned about the possibility of a tariff war. The uncertainty makes it difficult for businesses to plan, Carlos Jaramillo, president of the Tijuana Business Coordinating Council, says.
The reality is that we don't necessarily have to talk about China, but we do need to consider other markets. We can't remain so heavily dependent on the United States.
Concerns are particularly acute in Mexico's border cities. Maquiladoras, factories that import materials for assembly and export finished products to the U.S., are a major driver for local economies. Tariffs would not only severely disrupt the supply chain, but also the workforce's livelihood, warns manufacturing expert Ricardo Melgoza.
This would increase unemployment here in Mexico, in Ciudad Juarez. Inflation will obviously hit us because residents of Juarez also buy many American products.
That would affect the purchasing power of families living along the border. Veronica Villafañe, VOA News.
Heading back to Europe, this time to Estonia. There is a new education initiative there that will give every high schooler in the country access to AI. I speak with Sim Sikut, who's one of the initiators from the AI Leap program team.
Essentially, we are aiming to bring AI tools free for all the high school and vocational school students and the teachers starting from September this year, which is the beginning of the next school year.
And what will the students be learning or doing with those with the AI tools?
Essentially, our idea is that we want to make sure that in whatever subject they take, actually the AI tools are being used to the best possible way in that subject. I mean, what are the exact tricks and things? That's still very much in development. So basically, subject by subject or class by class, this is like the program is being made in the next months. But essentially, it just comes down to that, you know, the kids coming out of the school, going to the unis, going to the labor market, would really know how to, like, literally make the most of these things available, things like ChatGPT.
Now, this is a fairly large program in Estonia. You want every student to have access to these tools. How many kids is that? How many schools? What scale are we talking about?
So we are starting from 10th and 11th grade. I mean, these would be then the sophomores and juniors of high school. School, and we're talking about 20,000 students and 3,000 teachers this autumn, and then roughly the same or a bit more for next year when we add vocational schools and the incoming classes and things. So it is large, but our idea is exactly that. Look, many of these kids have some versions of Gen AI and, you know, in their pockets already, but A, they are using them in all kinds of random ways, and B, not everybody has them. So it's also a bit of, let's say, equity program that literally every kid would have a chance.
Now, technology in classrooms is often a double-edged sword, and clearly there's advantages, as you've stated, to giving kids access to these tools in school, but there's also some risk. How do you mitigate that, and how do you make that balance?
Well, our thinking is actually a bit of simpler than that, in a sense that in many ways, the bad use is already there. I mean, if it's just basically uncheckered or like, you know, again, if kids are left by their own devices to figure out what to do with or how to use them, really. I mean, they frankly will resort to the least meaningful use possible, like, you know, just like, you know, getting the essays done and things like that. It comes down to that, essentially, we have to subject by subject figure out ways what kind of right questions to ask from AI assistants and the tools there. So in that sense, like I said, to make sense that they're meaningfully learning with them, not just somehow getting an easier way to get the homeworks done with them.
Now, you're not worried about kids using these AI tools to, say, maybe do their homework for them or cheat in some other classes?
Well, we'll see, but that's my point. I mean, this is happening anyway. So but that's happening in a way that it doesn't really contribute to their learning much at all, right? Literally, just like we have stats that about 50% to 60% of high schoolers, one way or another, are making use of them. But that's not conducive to basically gaining new knowledge, or that's not conducive to them sitting down in the office later in their life and really just, you know, making sure that now they become more productive with them.
Now, this is done in partnership with ChatGPT. Are you worried at all that by putting all your eggs in one basket with ChatGPT, you are limiting your students to some of the other tools that are out there in the marketplace?
Well, actually, first of all, we are not limiting just to ChatGPT or our good friends at OpenAI. I mean, from the start, we're talking to all the major providers. Secondly, we will be an open platform for actually even, let's say, the small next edtech startups to come and join, for that matter. So it won't be limited to just one tool only. But secondly, I mean, being a user of several platforms myself, even, look, the skills are transferable. So if you know how to write a prompt, I mean, that skill is usable in the next sort of tool the same sort of ways.
So clearly, this is a bigger plan for Estonia than just giving kids in school these tools. There is a plan for what Estonia will look like in 5, 10, 20 years once your population has this education. What's the future look like?
Two things there. Well, first of all, I mean, you're right. We are starting with the children, and this is very much goes back to what was our experience about 30 years ago. Similarly, title program Tiger Leap brought back in the day internet and, you know, pieces of computers to all the schools. And the impact was that, like, you know, a little generation was born that had now advanced user skills. It's the same sort of idea we're trying to unleash. So 5 years from now, these will be hopefully girls and boys who are launching the next sort of apps, things, companies that become unicorns possibly, right? But secondly, it's also... the aim, where you start with education system, is that one thing is that you learn to use the tools properly. But secondly, with the help of the tools there, we can hopefully make education better, more personalized, more because, you know, AI can help you also mold or adjust the way, the content, the style of your studying and teaching to everyone's needs better than possible so far. So another aim is also to literally get better educational outcomes.
Sim Sikut is a program initiator with the AI Leap program in Estonia. Mr. Sikut, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for telling us about the program.
Thank you.
And finally today, a story that is admittedly better on TV than on the radio, but worth sharing nonetheless. You can visit our website at voanews.com to watch it. VOA's Anna Rice narrates this story about an Oscar-nominated documentary film called Porcelain War, and explores the importance of art during wartime.
Sublime and stirring, breathtaking, an artistic triumph, a truly heroic piece of filmmaking. Rave reviews in the press, a 99% all audience rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and the US Grand Jury Prize for Documentaries at the Sundance Film Festival. All for the film Porcelain War, which follows Ukrainian artists Slava Leontiev, Anastasienko, and Andriy Stefanov during Russia's war with Ukraine. The three of them join Ukraine's defense, and Leontiev and Stasienko continue to make art in a show of resistance.
My wife, Anya Stasienko, and I, we've been making porcelain figures for many years now. They've become quite famous around the world. But we've never thought about doing cinematography, of course.
Neither did they think of leaving their home country when Russia invaded in February 2022. Instead, they chose to fight, and after long days on the front lines, Leontiev would make porcelain figurines at night.
The idea that he was remaining in Ukraine to continue making art, we thought was absolutely remarkable.
Even before the war, American director Brendan Belomo wanted to make an animated film based on the fantastical creatures that Leontiev and Stasienko made from porcelain. In a way, he did fulfill his dream, but the essence of the film ended up completely different.
We were separated by 6,000 miles. We didn't speak the same language. We could only communicate over Zoom with an interpreter. And we were, you know, divided by the largest conflict in Europe since World War II.
It was a surreal experience to receive. In one huge bag, a bulletproof vest, a camera, a special helmet, a sound recorder, etc.
The couple's friend Andriy Stefanov became the cinematographer.
Andriy is a very unusual person, a jack of all trades, a perfectionist. So when I told him about the idea of filming, he said he wasn't ready. But we've known him for too long. So I said, of course you're not ready. It's already dark out today. Don't worry, we start tomorrow. So be ready.
Critics fell in love with this film because of its visual language. A porcelain snail carrying a house on its shell. A drone that doubles as a dragonfly. A wise old owl. Anya Stasienko's drawings come to life in this film.
Anya decided from the very start that Ukraine will never look pathetic in our film. Ukrainians will never look like helpless victims, because we knew from day one that Ukraine will demonstrate unprecedented resilience and bravery.
The film's metaphor is straightforward. Despite its fragility, porcelain, like Ukraine, becomes strong under fire. For Yelena Wolf in New York, NRI's VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, Thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.